The Gentle Rebel Podcast.
For introverts, highly sensitive people, and creative misfits.
Hello, welcome to the Gentle Rebel Podcast. I'm Andy Mort, and I'd love to explore what can happen when we slow down, find our natural, gentle rhythm, and move at a pace that suits us best as individuals so that we can experience more joy, meaning, and creative purpose in our short and strange lives together on this planet. I hope you're doing well this week. I'm really glad to be bringing you a conversation in this week's episode with a returning guest and a friend of the show, Jacob Nordby, who has a new book coming out, this weekend as I'm recording this. It's called The Creative Cure, How Finding and Freeing Your Inner Artist Can Heal Your Life. And it contains a foreword from Julia Cameron, who's author of The Artist's Way, which I know a lot of people have been kind of re-exploring for the first time over the past 12 months or so, like during the pandemic. I know a lot of people following that stuff. So it's been great to kind of connect with creativity and art and that stuff since being locked down and that kind of thing. Jacob sees creativity as much more than something we do. It is like who we are, and that's kind of one of the deep values of this podcast and of what I do. You know, creativity is an antidote to the stagnation, the unhappiness, the self-judgment, the kind of automated living that's left so many of us feeling unfulfilled. And what I'm really looking forward to, so I haven't actually recorded this the interview yet, so I'm hoping it happens. I'm due to speak to Jacob later today, but I thought I'd kind of just get on and do this before we spoke, so that it's kind of more authentic that way, isn't it? And what I'm really looking forward to exploring with Jacob is this idea of creativity being a cure and what that means, and what it is that we need curing from, and how creativity plays that part. I've got an inkling that it might be a cure from the need for a cure. I'm really interested to ask Jacob more about that. How we kind of live life in this place of anxiety, where we're encouraged to believe that we're not enough. We need to do more. We need to buy more. We need to be more. We need to have more in order to show that we are worthy, whatever that means. And it can be the same within the world, the kind of self-development world itself as well. You know, like follow this program or purchase that course and you'll find the cure for the thing that you feel like you're lacking, or the thing that needs healing, whether it's your lack of confidence or general feelings of dissatisfaction, your need for happiness, those kinds of things. But what I love about this book is it kind of roots us in practices that bring us into the present moment. So they take us out of that sort of sense that there's a cure. As long as you do this, you'll find the cure down the line. It's like, no, it makes the practice of creativity the moment of cure. So these are moments upon moments that we build life. And creativity, it's not taking us towards a cure or towards this point of healing in the future, whatever that might look like or be. Creativity is curing our desire for a cure. You know, every time we bring ourselves into those practices, we forget that we're looking to scratch that impossible itch. And as we step into creativity with regularity, with humility, with groundedness. So humility means kind of groundedness. And a sense that this is not about taking us somewhere. It is somewhere. We are returning in that moment to our truest self and into a place of love and belonging within this place itself. So just to give a little bit of context to the book, so it addresses the three enemies of creativity and of life, living in sync with our inner creative self. So those are socialization, traumatic experiences, and rejection. So socialization being the beliefs, the behaviors, the tastes, the personal goals that we've picked up from the world around us. The stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves, about other people, about the way the world is. And these often kind of counter the story of our true creative selves. And then traumatic experiences, you know, if we experience trauma, especially in our formative years, Jacob says it can lead to patterns of anxiety, destructive self-talk, inner criticism and self-doubt, procrastination, perfectionism, addictive behaviors, and feelings of not being valuable. or lacking a purpose. And then rejection is kind of the intersection of those two things, of socialization and of trauma. When we violate the rules of our families, religion, society at large, it can lead to rejection of all kinds. And so we seek to avoid that kind of rejection at all costs. So we do what we must to fit in or to not be seen. And we've talked about that a little bit over the past few weeks. And that this inevitably costs us our authentic creative expression. So, yeah, I hope that kind of sets things up a little bit. I'm really, really excited to chat with Jacob and to see where our conversation goes. I will be back after our chat just to, I don't know, reflect on what we talked about, as I don't yet know what we talked about, and just to fill in any gaps that might be missing or that I would have loved to have talked about, and to just chat about that a little bit. So yeah, I hope you enjoy it. Here's me talking, hopefully, to Jacob Nordby. See you in a bit. Jacob, how you doing, man?
Oh, I'm really well, Andy. Good to see your face, man. It's been too long.
I know. It's so good to have you back on the Gentle Rebel podcast. I'm really excited to, yeah, have a chat with you, catch up, and hear more about the new book that you have. Well, it should be out by the time most people listen to this, hopefully.
Well, I love you, and I love what you're doing. I love the Gentle Rebel tribe, man. So it's just really cool to be here.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. So, I mean, yeah, tell me more about what's been going on, like the creative cure. What have you learned writing this book? Why have you written this book? Just some small questions to start with.
Oh, yeah, let's dive right into the deep end. Andy, it's interesting. I'm sure you have this experience creatively, but it's funny. I've written, this is my third book now, and I didn't realize the pattern, but it seems like one book every 4 years. So they've been all three have been 4 years apart, and each represents this kind of, you know, I kind of envy writers or other artists who they just create stuff that's cool and fun, and it doesn't require personal transformation all the time. It seems like everything I'm working on is like, I've got to live right straight through the middle of it, you know? So this book definitely changed me a lot. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's really cool. So sort of embodying the process as you were writing the process.
Yeah. And that sounds neat as a concept, but doing it feels messy and weird and depressing. And like, is this ever going to work? And maybe this is a pile of hot garbage, and maybe I'm a pile of hot garbage, and you know, all that stuff.
That's what it's all about. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really interested to hear more about that word cure, because I really like the kind of idea of using creativity as a cure, but also looking for the cure for creativity, so like unlocking more creativity, you know, in your life. And I was struck by the idea, especially with some of the kind of exercise, the practices that you talk about, how it's almost the cure for the need for a cure, if that makes sense. So, so often in life we have there's that pressure to be more, to buy more, to have more, and all that sort of stuff. And it like we have all these things that promise wholeness and completeness and the answer and all of that sort of stuff. And to some degree, the idea of the cure could be a part of that, but it's not. Like it's almost like the creativity is a practice with moments of cure. Like the cure is in the creative practice as you show up to it. Yeah. And I really like that as an idea. I just wonder what do you see the creative cure curing?
You know, Andy, I think what surprised me most, I wrote this book, I don't know, 6 or 7 times, and then the editors took it over, you know. What surprised me most was I was searching for exactly what you're talking about there, the heart of, okay, what is this creativity thing? And I wasn't satisfied with the idea that it's just the expression of art or something original. Like it felt like it was deeper than that. And I was struggling for what, what is this essence, you know? And this sentence did not make it into the final version, but I started the introduction with the sentence, "We need to rescue creativity from the arts." And then I followed that up with, you know, not that artists, inventors, and geniuses don't get to have it. Of course they do. But what I would love is for us to strip away the idea that creativity is sort of the commodity, or, you know, it's owned by people who self-identify as creative. Because as I began to really let this work me over, what I discovered is we all have a spark. And I loved that movie that Disney or Apple just came out with, Soul. And it talked about that. I'm sitting there going, oh my God, they're talking about the same stuff. We all have this spark and we show up with it. It's this essential energy of life. And so many things conspire to dim that, to fade the connection, to put static in this connection. And so what I'm really exploring here and seeking to live in my own life is a daily practice of reconnecting with the inner self, because, or I, what I call the inner creative self, because to me that is the essential self. And whatever we do, so many different ways to reconnect with that, it heals the connection, because that inner self, that creative self, is never lost. It's never broken. It's never damaged. It never becomes worthless, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, what's the essence of that inner creative self? Have you kind of identified like what that looks like or feels like or sounds like?
Well, yeah, let's do it, Andy. What's a moment, take me back to you're an amazing storyteller. Take me back to a moment, the first one that comes to mind, as a child when you were completely in your joy. Like, what's a moment that just, memory that just pops up, something you were doing?
For me, it's probably running around the garden playing football or soccer. Okay. On my own, just like making up scenarios that I'm involved in.
Yeah.
I think that used to be like, if I needed to just go and escape into something as a kid, I just put my little football boots on and run outside. And that, you know, it didn't really matter what the weather was like, whether it was dark and I couldn't see anything. That was real joy. Yeah.
I wish everyone could see your face change as you went into that memory. And just for a minute, for the fun of it, just close your eyes and just let yourself time travel back there and let yourself actually feel running out in the rain, grabbing your ball, what Americans call your soccer ball, grabbing your football and doing it. Can you feel the energy of that?
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a moment. There's this elusive, ephemeral, but powerful energy of that. And then the adult mind wants to say, well, that's fine. But, you know, unless you're a famous football player, you can't make a living at it. How you pay your bills with it, all those things. But reconnecting with that joy, reconnecting with that thing. And you do it, Andy, with what you're doing right now with your podcast and with your music and all the ways you express yourself. But I would love, to me, the cure is in the reconnecting, because the medicine is that self. That's the medicine. It's not me. It's not a book. It's not a retreat or a workshop somewhere. It's already in every one of us, everyone who's listening right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly, you know, talking about the cure from the cure, is that, because I think we connect, don't we, to almost the idea that this might take me to the cure. So I need to do this practice in order to get to this point at some point down the line. That will be the moment where, yeah, finally I'm free. And it's like, no, actually, it's the practice itself that gives you that moment of, you know, just stepping back into that memory. That is a moment of cure. Like, that is it.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it right there. And I loved that you captured the essence so quickly, like just when you started framing the questions, even. the message that many of us get, I would say most of us get to some degree, it's a very ancient narrative. And it's, you know, for many of us, it has religious sort of underpinnings. Not everyone was raised religiously, but it's become the religion of most of the world, which the linchpin idea is original sin. You were born broken. And if we pull that out and say, what if that just isn't true? What if I was born amazing, perfect enough? Because everything that follows in marketing and in politics and in self-help and in personal development, all these things, the message keeps coming through, and you nailed it right off the bat, Andy. You're not enough. You're not enough as you are. You need this book. You need this program. You need this tooth whitener. You need six pack abs or bigger breasts or whatever it is, you know?
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's part of so you've got the trio of things that sort of stand in the way of our creativity, our getting back to our creative selves, which is the socialization, traumatic experiences, and what's the third one? Rejection.
Yeah. You've been reading the book.
I have indeed. Yeah. So I wonder how do they kind of work into that sort of the adult narrative, that framework that takes us away from that, childlikeness, the inner child part.
Well, I just think, okay, so let's go back to how old were you in that memory, in the garden with your football?
Oh, I think I was about, it's difficult to, it's one of those sort of outside of time things,
yeah. But
it's probably around the 7, 8, 9, that sort of age.
Okay. Yeah. Psychologists tell us that about in that area, you know, we're moving into school days. So our personal world is being structured by schedules that we probably wouldn't have chosen, you know. What's interesting to me is socialization. You know, it's a big word, concept, but it's the process of becoming an adult human in the modern world, you know, or in any world, but let's just say in the modern world, it's how we learn to do everything: walk, ride a bike, eat, use the bathroom, spell, everything. So everything, we can't really become an adult human civilized person without mimicking others and learning from others. So that's the one thing, Andy, is that we have to learn through mimicry and comparison. And as we do that, we learn, or we get the message very quickly. Yeah, you're not enough. Your instincts aren't good. Your instincts will lead you astray. Even the word counterintuitive, I hear it so often. And what people really mean most of the time when they say it, it's not counterintuitive, it's counterconditioning. They say, oh, well,
I never thought about that. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, no, your intuition, which lives in your body and your psyche, you know, and it picks up all this information. It actually knows things that then we're conditioned very quickly through socialization to begin to ignore. Mm. Right. So that's one thing, socialization. By the time we become 20 or 30 and God help us 40 or older, our perspective and our habits of the way we live and the way we see truth, the way we see how we are supposed to be, success, failure, all of those things are calcified. There are these definitions that say, here's who you are supposed to be. And we develop this persona, this other self, through adaptive and survival strategies. And then that takes us into traumatic experiences. And, you know, this book you asked early, you know, what changed me. And when I really got to rewriting this thing in 2019, I had just finished up a creative unboot camp course. And I had a stretch of about 45 days that surprisingly had more space in them than I think I'd had probably in the rest of my adult life. And it was the middle of winter here in northern United States. So it was cold and dark, and I was feeling really depressed. And in the past, Andy had always treated that depression as an enemy, something to run away from or work over the top of or do something. Somehow, though, and I had this book rewrite deadline looming. somehow some kind of inner wisdom said, you need to stop. Hmm. You need to just let, like, befriend this. What's it has wisdom for you. So I began to go into that and each day treat the darkness in myself and outside as a gift and say, or a friend and say, well, we're not friends yet, but you have something to tell me. I want to get to know you better. And what's interesting is during that process, a 7-year-old version of myself showed up and, wow, this is interesting. So I began to ask him through, you know, techniques, journaling and meditation. I began to ask him, what do you need? And his eyes were so tired. And he just said, can we please just rest? Hmm. And it went against all of my conditioning, everything that says, this is how you have value. You just work, you know, you get up and you work, you prove that you're valuable. So I would, Andy, I would spend for that month or so, I would get up in the morning and I would take care, you know, I would take care of things, make sure my kids were off to school or work or wherever they needed to go and make sure there was food and, you know, answer emails or whatever. But I would spend most of the day resting. And after about 30 days, and when I say resting, I'd also use the journaling as a process of asking, like, what do you need? How do you feel? And I began realizing I was creating this dialogue with my inner self. What would you love? And I began taking these recesses to just dream and imagine, which felt really illegitimate and strange at first because I was so conditioned to anticipate disappointment, anticipate like turning down dreams, turning down what's possible to something more manageable or realistic. At the end of that period, I just noticed the feeling faded, but the presence of that inner self didn't. And then I felt like it was okay to start rewriting the book. And I did that and it happened in about 45 days and it was an entirely different thing. So I feel really grateful. The processes I'm talking about in there really are born from that wounded healer journey of, I don't want to just go find cures and then hand them over to other people. I need to take this medicine myself. I need to find out what it's all about.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. That man, such a great story of, yeah, just almost trusting the process that has been brought to you by your 7-year-old inner self, which is not a process at all. It's just a wait, just stop. It made me think when you're talking about this, the kind of socialization as well of, and going back to my, you know, running around the garden, kicking a football. Like, I kind of remember it was probably a transition period where that kind of self-consciousness really kicked in. And the idea that someone might be watching me kind of took over and then eventually made me stop doing it, which to some degree is, you know, that's a natural part of growing up, isn't it? That actually you transition out of being a child into, you know, an older person. But it's the message that gives you the reason for doing that, which is a really powerful thing. And I was just wondering about, made me think, you know, because you, I think, mention in the book about or refer to people being stuck in sort of childish ways. Basically, like, what's the difference between childlike and childish? Because I feel like there's an important distinction between accessing our inner child in a really free and creative way and being stuck in kind of childish ways of being an adult, if that makes sense.
Mm, yeah.
Almost regressive.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? So I think that's one of the reasons a lot of us resist doing that work and getting simple again, is because there's so much stigma around the idea of being childish, which, I don't know, let's make a list real time here, Andy. What are some things of not childlikeness, where it's free and like innocent and bold and all those things, vulnerable, honest. What are some words that come to mind when you think of childishness that carry a sort of negative tone?
I guess not. It's the kind of expecting somebody else to take responsibility for the things that you need to take responsibility for.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
So not resourceful. kind of almost like a, I can't do this for myself.
Yeah.
What about unrestrained and inappropriate anger, or, you know, like unfettered emotion that really isn't appropriate for the situation, like mm-hmm. screaming and crying and throwing yourself on the floor when you don't get a piece of candy?
Yeah. Which I suppose, again, is the expecting somebody else to almost regulate your emotions for you, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. No, right. Yeah. What are, I'm curious, interesting to have this conversation. Like, what are some other, when you think about a child who really is just a pain in the ass to be around, what are the pain in the assnesses about that kid?
They're ultra competitive in the sense of you can't play games with them because all they want to do is win and they don't care about anybody else. Not that I'm speaking from any kind of experience with an annoying kid on it.
Yeah, I was thinking like very little respect for other people's boundaries. You know, like they'll just come crashing into a conversation, start just telling their story or demanding something without any regard for what's going on in the room there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it's interesting as as I take that stuff apart, that's, I think, what creates this fear of doing the kind of work or practice or play or whatever it is we're talking about to go back there is, it's like this fear of, no, I don't want to lose all the wisdom or the social acumen or any of these things the skills I've learned through the process of becoming this adult, because that is part of the trajectory of the development of a psyche, right? Of mm-hmm. learning these things, gaining wisdom. So I think, you know, when I think back about some of the ancient teachers and Jesus Christ and in the Buddhist principles and things, it's interesting that there's this recurring theme of unless you become like a little child.
Yeah.
Or you need to regain the child's mind or the beginner's mind. And that seems to be this key. Mm. And so to me, it's fascinating to make these connections. And, you know, during that period of time I was telling you about, actually befriending these feelings and asking what they had to tell me, I was also deep in the middle of reading a book called The Body Keeps the Score, which is a beautiful and really well-researched treatise on trauma and how it affects the brain and the nervous system. And I also read during that period of time The Deepest Well, which is another amazing book with a tremendous amount of research and big data behind it. And I began to see myself in the mirror, Andy. So now we're talking about the second enemy, you know, trauma, traumatic experiences. And I didn't ever want to see myself as a trauma victim. You know, I didn't like that idea. I certainly have compassion for other people who have been through those things. But when I began to read the just clinical data and go through the adverse childhood experiences quiz, you know, assessment, I began to see in black and white. It's like, you know, to take on this story of, you know, oh, I'm such a victim, but just looking at it and saying, I had those experiences, I had them during my formative years. Here's how those things then generate early production of stress hormones in the body, cortisol, adrenaline. Here's how that keeps your nervous system dysregulated. And then as an adult, you wonder why there's a latent level of stress and anxiety, why it's hard to ever settle down and relax, why you feel like the other shoe is going to drop all the time, why you fear the wolf at the door, all these metaphors. Learning that there was a way to actually heal the nervous system through these practices and settle into the polyvagal state, the parasympathetic nervous system state, that's like, oh my God. I remember then after that 45-day period and then continuing these practices of, you know, simple mindfulness and journaling and walking, I began to just notice that I would wake up in a more calm state. And I remember one day having a feeling of anxiety and going, oh, I actually feel anxiety. And then the next thought was, that's how I used to feel all of the time. So it's no longer my baseline state. What a miracle.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, would that have been a thing that you'd have recognized the anxiety in the kind of previous time, or
I didn't even know it was there.
It's only because you had something almost to compare it to and that other feeling.
That's right. Yeah. And didn't realize, you know, and again, in those books I just mentioned, and some other research into traumatic experiences, you know, they're the big traumas, the ones that are show up on the ACEs assessment. And, you know, we all hear about them, you know, the sexual violations or the parents who go to jail or, you know, these big things. But what a lot of us don't realize is that we experience paper cut traumatic experiences at an early formative age and don't realize as adults looking back, we tend to reframe them and go, that was no big deal. What's interesting to me, though, is that some very seemingly minor things color the entire sky of a child's imagination and perception of the world and how they begin to then develop an identity, a picture of themselves. And so things that seem like no big deal, like, sure, everyone gets teased at school or everyone's parents get divorced or, you know, I mean, whatever the things are, that as adults, we look back and say, well, that was no big deal. The fact is, when it happens in a developing psyche, and some of these things began to happen before we were even verbal, precognitive. So they actually go so deep and they're so old that our nervous systems begin to respond to those threats, seemingly small as looking back at them, but at the time they were important events. And they become rooted in there, which then develops these limiting self-belief, these roots, Andy. And those things tell us later in life, and they're invisible. They're below the surface as roots are. I'm not worthy. I'm not lovable. I'm not safe. I'll be rejected. They'll abandon me. All of these things. And those roots then run the show for the rest of our lives until or unless we begin the process of healing deep down and slowing down and beginning to recognize them. And the good news is the practices to do that can be so simple, you know?
Mm. Yeah. So the roots that are the things we basically don't want, or we want to, you know, we're afraid of looking at and seeing and, you know, experiencing, then grow out from them those kinds of things. I'm thinking of, like, you know, perfectionism and attaching to the things we think are going to keep us from the unworthiness and that pursuit of more of whatever it is.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe let's sort of just, yeah, sort of touch on perfectionism a little bit, because I know a lot of people, you know, listening to this experience a bit of perfectionism. You know, I talk about it to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, how does that kind of get in the way of creativity and coming back to ourselves in that sense?
Isn't it interesting that perfectionism and procrastination are basically like conjoined twins? Mm. Like, what would I just go ahead and do or try if I weren't worried about it not coming out perfectly? You know, what would I go out there and just do with boldness and curiosity and innocence and interest if it didn't have to show up perfectly, if I weren't afraid of being rejected, you know, by myself, by other people. So it's interesting as we're playing with this together here, just, it feels like those things are so connected, and they are leaves, branches, fruits of that deep root of, I'm not worthy. I'm not lovable. I'll be rejected. I'll be abandoned. You know, those kinds of things. I'm not good enough. And feel free to jump in here. I'm loving this dialogue. Like, I feel like these things are so deeply connected. And if we go, so people, I used to call myself a writing coach or a creative coach, and I stopped doing that because, and I, by the way, I love coaching. I think there's a wonderful place for it, but I found that every time I begin doing what we call coaching, which is typically focused on changing a behavior so we can get a different result. What I found, though, Andy, was I was hacking away at branches and leaves when every time what we're dealing with is the root, you know. Mm. If we really want to change that, we have to go, like, if I say, okay, Andy, because people would show up and say, I want to finish writing my book. I'm tired of procrastinating. I need you to kick my ass. right? I used to be a personal trainer. People would show up to the gym. I need you to kick my ass. Wow. Okay. Do you really need your ass kicked? Is your inner creative self just dying to have its ass kicked? I don't know. That doesn't feel right somehow.
No, it doesn't, does it? No.
Beat you into creativity.
Yeah. There's something blocking that. There's a reason that you need your ass kicking, or you think you need your ass kicking in the first place, isn't there?
There it is. Yeah. Like, I deserve to be punished. I need to be punished. I won't behave. I won't do the right thing without being punished. Isn't that interesting?
Mm. It's weird, isn't it? Yeah. And there's also the, just thinking of the procrastination and perfectionism thing. When you look at other people doing the thing that you kind of want to do and they're not doing it perfectly, and you're okay with the fact that they're not doing it perfectly.
Yeah, of course.
And I constantly, you know, you constantly get that. And yet when you come to do it, you need to do it perfectly. And it's like, what's the kind of discrepancy there? It's bizarre.
Well, it is. And I'm thinking, I suddenly got taken back to your garden with your football. And you think about then how we take a something that feels so pleasurable, you know, and imaginative, kicking the ball around the garden and creating these scenarios. And you no doubt, I'm going to put words in your mouth, and you feel free to correct this, this little video clip I have of you in my imagination, Andy, of you no doubt could hear the crowd cheering and you could see yourself just kicking that thing through the goal and like, whoa, everything happened. I mean, is that true or not?
That's pretty much it. Yeah. Yeah.
So what happened when you then went to school and started did you actually begin playing football at school?
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
So tell me about that. Like what happened next?
I mean, it was, so it's sports always been one of those things that I've enjoyed. So I'm a massive sports fan. Like I'll watch sport.
Yeah.
And I used to play until a certain point where it became, I don't know, it became quite the ultra competitiveness and the fact that people cared more about winning than about just enjoying. Like I used to love the feeling of kicking a ball around, like messing around with skills and, you know, developing all of that stuff that was very much kind of, you know, similar to how I have with music as well. I get great joy from the intrinsic growth of just small bits of progression and learning and stuff like that. And so I'd get that for myself. And then when it came into this wider context where it was like, no, we've got to win. And so it just lost all its enjoyment for me.
And that
was okay to some degree, because it was like, okay, this isn't for me. Like if this is how it is, then that's fine. I'll find that joy somewhere else. But it was also a bit sad, because it was like that thing that I was connected to when I was younger, or the idea of it, it's like, it's not quite, in reality, it's not quite, doesn't have that same joy.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. And by the way, I think this is a very natural process of finding out what we love and what our gifts are. So I probably have a similar experience to you in that I loved going outside and playing hard. And I really enjoyed that part. And my hand-eye coordination just wasn't fantastic. I had a lot of heart, a lot of spirit. And so I was frequently kind of picked the last on the team for whatever it was. But when I would get out there and play, they're like, man, you're not very good, but you play hard. So I was kind of always welcomed, even though they weren't going to pass me the ball very often. Yeah. But I loved that experience. But then watching my younger brother, Isaac, who was just born with this grace, man. His body just knows the mechanics, right? Mm. And he's over 40 now and plays, you know, basketball a couple times a week. And he just has always known. That's one of his gifts, is this fluid, like, grace. And he has no interest in sitting down and writing things or showing up on podcasts. So I love watching how it is we sort of discover the things that we can really be good at. But what you describe of moving into the area of competitiveness and being compared to and then fearing rejection, like, oh man, I missed that goal again, or, mm-hmm. you know, I stepped on my teammate's foot, or what, you know, whatever it is, whatever dumb thing it was. And then, you know, we catch the glances, or the coach yells at us, or our parents kind of won't meet our eyes when we, you know, come off the field, or whatever those things are. And none of them, by the way, is this big, dark, sinister thing. It's just the paper cut thing that begins to tell us you're not good enough. You're not good enough. Now, again, I want to be careful here, because that is part of the process of being on earth and figuring out what it is we can be really good at and what brings us even more joy, you know. As a kid, I tried many things. I drew, I painted, I did the sports stuff. I ran around in the woods and built forts. I sang, you know, so I had all these different things. And it wasn't until later that I began to realize, I had this experience, Andy, of playing a violin. Actually, my father made the violin that I still have. I haven't played it for a while, but I would like to go back to that. But I really loved the violin, and I would play it a lot, and started around age 7, and then eventually developed to where I could join a youth orchestra, symphony in our town. And I remember asking my violin teacher when I was about 15. She was very, very good. She was first chair in an adult symphony. And I asked her, do you think that I have what it takes to become a professional violinist? Because I was working really hard at it, you know. And she said one of the most amazing things. She said, Jacob, you actually do. But you have to understand what it would cost you. She said, you aren't as naturally gifted as some of the child prodigies that I mentioned at the time. She's like, they just were sort of born, and they also started at age 2 or 3, and they really didn't have anything else they did all of their time up until they're 15, which is why they're currently on the world stage. She said, for you to catch up right now, you'd have to pretty much give up everything except the violin. You'd have to spend 8 to 10 hours a day practicing. You wouldn't have a job. You wouldn't have a social life. You wouldn't have anything. So you have to ask yourself, is that really what I want? And I loved that, because she didn't say you can't. She just said, you have to ask, what is it going to cost me?
That's a really powerful question. Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because and that really and used that.
Was helpful. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I was just thinking, like, we could use that question so much more in, mm-hmm. you know, when we talk about, like, you know, what do you want to be? Like, what's your dream? All of this stuff. And actually, yeah, what would that cost you in terms of, and weighing that up against, is it worth it for you? Or is the violin just something that brings you a sense of joy, that you can get that joy from playing it in the evening or a little bit of the weekend? And, and actually that gives you probably more, potentially more joy than if you were to like sell your entire life to that process of becoming the professional.
Andy, that's right. And I think this is sort of connected to the other idea of purpose here, and people have this question of what's my purpose, and they look at people maybe like you on stage playing with your band, or doing what you're doing right now. Or they look at a writer or, you know, somebody out there, and they go, okay, that person found their purpose. And they feel this sense of depression, like, I couldn't ever get good enough at one thing to pay the bills and to be recognized for being amazing at it. And so they go, well, I guess I'm just one of those people who won't ever find my purpose. And when I began to realize that purpose can be so much simpler, and it actually was such a relief to me to realize that that spark that showed up as me, as you, it didn't know any of the rules about success or what it takes or discipline or anything. It seemed to be curious about experience and learning and growth. You know, before it even knew its own name, it was trying to probably learn how to walk or crawl. And so what if the simplest purpose of life is joy? And what if I can find purpose in many, many things? like right now I showed up and wanted to, you know, I took a shower, you know, and I wanted to show up with a clean face and talk with you and listen to you. And so I'm feeling a sense of joy as I do that with you, because you're a fun guy. You make that easy.
I appreciate you washing your face for me.
Yeah, right. I mean, let's try at least. No, but then later today I'll be, you know, sending emails and setting up an event. I'll be working on getting this book launched and feeding my cat and running my son to his job and being a friend. And as I began to see that at my most inner self, my purpose is expressed and found in so many different ways. And it began to then help me relax about finding my great purpose, my great grand purpose. And what's interesting is there's this odd, I shouldn't reveal this probably, Andy, because it's this paradox. And the mind loves to grab onto that part and go, okay, so I'll do this. So then I will. Mm. But what's interesting is I find as we relax, as I relax into the simple purpose of joy and giving my whole self to whatever I'm up to at the moment, I actually get really good at a few things and actually start getting acknowledgement and appreciation for things. And what we might call success starts to show up more easily and weirdly and in a good way. And so it's this paradox, you know, it's like the path of least resistance. As I let go of this fixed goal of I have to become a New York Times bestseller or therefore that would otherwise it means I'm a failure. If it says, what if I could just show up and because it brings me joy to express things in words and watch how it connects with people, what if I just do the best thing I can there, whether it ever shows up on some list or not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a paradox that I recognize. And
sure you do.
Yeah. It is that sense of bringing, I suppose, that mindful awareness to every moment that you're in and accessing the joy, whatever that might look like within that moment. And I think, is it Eckhart Tolle talks about, you know, I guess holding the sense of having goals for the future at the same time as being completely in the now, and like the goal of walking across the room, you want to go and pick up a book from across the room, and the first task is walking across the room and to be fully in the joy of that process of walking across the room, and then just everything that you do you can start to find that real, I don't know, that presence, that awareness. And it doesn't have to all be about that thing in the future. Like, I need to go and get that book and everything becomes I need to get that so that I can do this, and then I'll have that. And then you never get to the final thing at the end. But then you get down the line and you realize, while I was so busy looking to the future, I missed out I was really quite happy, I think, back then, or I feel like I was happy, but I didn't experience it at the time. It's a whole load of weird paradoxes, I think, to some degree, but yeah.
Well, I think so too. And, you know, Andy, what we're talking about, I just love that we've been able to talk about real things, you know, real memories, real experiences. And I think that sometimes people will listen to, and I know I've done this many times, I've listened to a podcast or read a book, and I've thought, that sounds wonderful. And then I turn the player off or close the book and go back to what I call my real life and go, none of that works here. And this goes back to where you started the, you know, session here, where you said practice. And what I've discovered is making a little time every day to practice returning to myself, befriending myself, that inner self, asking myself very simple questions. How do I feel? What do I need? What would I love? Reactivating imagination in a very simple, sort of gentle way. I've found that by doing that day after day after day, it actually does make changes in what we call the real world, because I find myself more curious in the work I do for pay. I find myself more bold and less perfectionistic. I find myself better at working in relationships. My son is 19 and he lives with me. The other two are not far away, but they're on their own. And I have this time with my son, Jay, and it's just such an exciting thing for me to be in curiosity with him as he asks questions about what do I want to do next and how do I want to approach it. And I love, Andy, that I failed so many times down through my life at things that I learned along the way somewhere to stop being so pushy with myself and with other people. So rather than just rolling with all this anxiety and saying, you have to go to college and you have to figure out what you need to do, and then you've got to get the good grades, and then I'll be happy with you because I'll think you're going to do okay. And it's like, wait a minute. My sister, who's amazing at all this stuff, she asked me one day, what if you sat across from your son and pretended like you're talking to a 19-year-old version of yourself? Which is funny because my son's name is actually Jacob Nordby. So sitting across from him, I'm looking, I told him that one day, I said, you know, it's funny to me to sit here and talk with you because if I remember back to myself at age 19, I was raised differently, different economic circumstances, you know, very religiously, all these things that he doesn't have in his life. But I realized no one knew how to do this. And so I felt all of this pressure at age 19 to have it all figured out. And so I just rolled out into life full of panic and anxiety and pressure, and which created all of this chaos for me for the next couple of decades, Andy. And so it becomes interesting how this practice of curiosity and of befriending oneself, learning kindness again, it's interesting how it begins to affect every area of life. And so when we talk about the creative cure, the creative inner self, it really wants to restore and heal every part of life and not just be expressed in the one thing that we might call our art, you know?
Mm. Yeah. That's just kind of, yeah, thinking about what you said about being as your 19-year-old self, going out into the world with a sense of chaos and confusion and I guess urgency and this need to have it all figured out and everything. And just bringing that to the idea of listening to a podcast and then thinking, well, that's all well and good, but that doesn't actually apply to real life. And I think so many things we approach with that sense of this has got to figure something out for me. And we have that urgency. And again, coming back to the marketing and the anxiety that's instilled through the way that we're socialized in that respect. And, you know, everything's about not being good enough or not being enough, not having enough, whatever. And so this urgency, this chaos is through so much of our society, and it is a real countercultural thing. It's, you know, I think it's at the heart of why I talk about gentle rebellion, because it's kind of just gently turning around the lens of how we're looking at things. And it's, you know, I'll go to a podcast and think, okay, this is going to, you know, I'll be attracted to a certain title that's like, right, that's going to solve that problem. And then you listen to it and it's like, well, it would if I had the same resources as the person who was talking on that podcast, or if I was in the same position as them, then it would be fine. It's okay for them, not for me, because I'm in a different situation. And you end up just in that same like maelstrom of like almost, I guess, I don't know if taking a kind of victim mentality is the right phrase, but you know what I mean? That's that kind of sense of, yeah, it's all right for them, but not for me. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. You're really an intuitive guy and host. It was funny, even as you were talking before, you mentioned how the connection with Gentle Rebel. That's one of the reasons I love the work you're doing here, is that you're really inviting all of us into a revolution. But unlike the revolutions that we've been seeing in the world recently, this isn't about going out and yelling at other people or breaking things. It's really about this inner revolution, because befriending ourselves and getting to know ourselves again, that is a rebellious act in a world that's taught us that we aren't good enough and that we shouldn't listen to ourselves. Those are rebellious acts.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. So yeah, as we kind of wind down. It's up to you. We can do what's the difference between winding up and winding down?
I don't know. Let's spend some time on that.
just kind of thinking about some maybe practical takeaways that people might be able to at least kind of think about, even if they don't think it's realistic for them as they turn off the podcast afterwards. Obviously you talked about kind of meditation and journaling. What are some kind of ways back to our creative selves, maybe within those realms and elsewhere?
Well, I think that those are a couple of practices. Some people are more kinesthetic, and so they find their connection through yoga or through running or walking or things like that. I really feel like there are so many paths inward, Andy, and I would love to invite everyone to try a very simple journaling practice. Ask three questions, and if you need a little help, you can find it on my site and download it, but here are the three questions. First one, how do I feel right now? So if you just grab a notebook, it doesn't have to be a special journal, just grab a notebook and write down, or even on your phone in a note or something. Well, first question, how do I feel right now? And this is not how should I feel, how do I wish I felt, how do I feel? And just write that out, a few sentences. Second question, what do I need right now? You notice I'm using right now because it keeps us in the present moment, not what do I need a year from now, what should I need? What I find is that asking that second question, what do I need right now? It often takes us back to a very simple, primitive expression. I would find myself saying, I need to pee right now, or I need a drink, or I'm really tired. I actually need a nap. And it was interesting, Andy, to have those things come up like that and go, wow, I've been ignoring myself and the very simplest needs that I have, you know. And you think about adults telling little kids, you know, no, it's not time right now. We need to go, you know, we need to keep moving, or we need, you know, you can't have a nap or a drink or whatever. So we get taught at an early age to ignore our needs. So that second question takes us back to very simple things. And it can also address things like, I need more money. I'm feeling worried about my taxes or whatever it is. So I find that progression, first question, second question, third question is, what would I love? Or some people need to use, I often need to use a version of that, how would I love to feel? I found myself often answering that, I would love to just feel safe. I would love to feel safe enough to relax right now. So that very simple journaling practice, it can be handled on a single page. I find myself sometimes running into three or four pages. That by itself tunes us into the voice of the inner self. And it begins to develop a little bit of trust that who I am and what I need and what I would dream of, what I would love, how I'd love to feel are valid and necessary. So I would like to invite everyone who's a little bit, you know, cynical. That's not the word I was thinking of, but I'll think of it later after this podcast is done. I'll say, oh my God, I wish I thought of that word then. No, but feeling a little skeptical, I think is the word, about, yeah, does any of this work in my life? I would just like to invite you to try that as a starting place for 5 or 10 minutes every day for a little while. Just see how you feel. And then the second one would be some sort of mindfulness. Sometimes people get worried about meditation because it's, you know, hard to do it perfectly or whatever. I would like to invite you to sit quietly for 4 or 5 minutes and breathe in. And as you breathe in, I am loved. And breathe out, I'm safe. And breathe in, I am seen. And breathe out, I'm enough. Try that for like 3 or 4 minutes. And what's interesting is when I started doing that myself and developing as a practice, old voices, old feelings in my body screamed out and said, these things are not true. I found that by doing it over and over again for the course of a few weeks, it started to feel more true. So those two practices, and they seem too simple to be effective, but those two practices began to heal the dysregulated nervous system, mine, not the as a concept, my own, I began to notice myself settling into a more curious, open, resourceful state on a daily basis.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. That's the power in the simplicity, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love those three questions of actually just bringing your mind to how you're feeling, both in terms of the emotional feeling. And also I really like the fact is that almost childlike physiological, you know, my mind just was taken to, you know, a kid who's so busy into something that you're like, you know the signs because they're like their legs are going up and down. He's like, you need to go to the toilet, don't you? You need to go to the toilet. No, I'm not. I'm fine. I don't need to go. Because they're so immersed in the thing that they're doing. And then, they end up like bombing it off when it gets too bad. But yeah, I don't know how that's relevant, but it's an image that just came to my head when you talking about
that. I think it's highly relevant. I mean, I don't want to interrupt you, but as you're saying that, I had this memory of myself in school with my feet going up and down like that. And the rule was you don't leave class to go to the bathroom. And I eventually wet my pants in school at age like 7 or 8. Right. And so early on just taught you don't get to do what you need to do when you need to do it. You have to follow the rule that says, I mean, that's just one example of it, you know, in church or many different places we might've experienced that with it is good to learn self-control. I'm not suggesting that, but it's interesting how we get these messages early on, some artificial reason why you can't pay attention to your own inner needs and feelings, you know,
especially those sorts of needs, which you either deal with that or someone else is going to have to deal with it. Yeah.
And then we experience shame and rejection and all of these things that then set up, and people think, how does that have to do with creativity? And my answer to that would just be, listen, your inner self, your creative inner self is powerful and wise, and it's also innocent and joyful, and it's bold, and it doesn't really care what people think. Think about a toddler running across the room in their diaper or their nappy, I think, with their belly sticking out. Yeah. Andy, running across the room and their belly is sticking out and they're grabbing a toy or a ball and you see them throw their arms back and they're like, oh, and if they could, they'd say, I'm awesome. Life is awesome. This is awesome. And recapturing some of that is possible.
Totally. Yeah. And just one more thing that's just come to my mind is also just thinking about like, I am tired. I need a nap or I need to sleep. And the messaging around laziness and no, you can't. And actually in taking a nap, what you're giving to society is a less grumpy, a less reactive, less irritable version of yourself. And what if the reason that one of the reasons we're in the position we are today with such a highly reactive, you know, emotionally reactive, hostile, angry, shouting sort of society, it's because actually we're not listening to those basic needs at the heart of, no, I'm tired. I just need to be able to kind of, care for my basic needs.
Man, I wish we had another hour, Andy. I love this so much. And I just want to say too that we live in a world that feels like it's so full of chaos, so many loud voices. Many of us who are sensitive types look out at the world and say, if we could all just stop yelling and listen to each other. And I just want to say that where any of that begins is learning to do it in ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. How can I listen to anyone else out there if I haven't learned to listen to myself?
Yeah.
And so these things that we're talking about today, they seem too simple and maybe too small to affect the rest of the world. But the truth is, the way I see it is that the more of us who are willing to become gentle rebels and learn how to heal that connection to this inner creative self, we actually become the cure that the world needs, and not by going out and trying to change the world, simply by being in our health and in our joy, you know? Mm.
Perfect way to end. Yeah. Beautiful. Oh man, Jacob, thank you so much. This has been a real treat. So I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're busy. So yeah, thank you.
Well, I'll just tell you, Andy, I've been looking forward to this, and you make it so easy to have this conversation. And I said it to begin with, and I meant it, and I mean it now again, reinforced by our conversation. I love you. I love your tribe, and I'm really glad we're able to spread a little more of this, because I feel like it's crucial right now. So.
Wow, kind of happened again. It's a similar thing to the last time we spoke. Jacob's got, he's got this kind of energy going on that just makes it a really, I don't know, connected conversation. And yeah, kind of challenging and just really enjoyable. I've just got back from a walk. So I recorded the, what's the time? Yeah, we did the interview about 4 hours, finished it 3 hours ago. So I edited it together, and then put it on my phone, and then took it for a walk because I couldn't really remember anything that we talked about in great detail. So I wanted to kind of refresh my memory before I then hopped on and talked here. But even still, I'm not in a place to kind of reflect too much right now. So, I mean, the things that really stood out, I suppose, is the stuff about joy. Like, there was some really great insights there, and I really enjoyed the thing with, you know, when he talked about the violin playing and the fact that, you know, having a violin teacher, he says, you know, you do have what it takes to become a professional violinist, but this is what it will cost. Are you aware of the cost? And I found that's a really powerful thing, and it speaks to a lot of the stuff that we, you know, when we get into those conversations about purpose, finding our purpose, and finding that thing that we're supposed to do, and committing to like a one thing, or believing that, you know, that's going to be the source of me finding myself, and actually everything comes with a cost, and just becoming aware of the cost, and deciding, you know, actually, is that cost, is the payoff worth the trade-off? And the thing that you get out of it might actually be something intrinsically within it that you can get just from, I don't know, a small dose of that thing. It might just be the, you know, taking a football out into the garden and having a little kick around rather than becoming the professional footballer, or just sitting down and singing a song at the piano rather than getting a record deal, whatever it is. Like, it, you know, we have these stories, we create these stories, don't we, about what this thing is going to mean, or what it's going to lead us to, or what, how we need to be defined in accordance with that thing that we think we're supposed to do, that search for the purpose. And actually it's the joy within some part of that that we can find. And yeah, like, is the story that we believe about where we want to go with it, is that worth the cost that it would take to get there? And yeah, I think I'll be thinking about the distinctions between childlike and childish. I mean, if you've got any thoughts on that, I think we kind of made a good start to that distinction, childlike versus childish. You know, I think the child, coming back to what we talked about last week and the entitlement, I think childish, there's an entitlement to a childishness that, compared with childlike, I think it's the childlike wonder, the childlike awe, the childlike play, the ability to see things through the eyes of imagination. It's the way we it's the way we give out to the world rather than the way we expect the world to give to us, I think is part of the difference between childlike and childish. But yeah, I don't know. And the other thing that I found really helpful was just those three questions for kind of journaling. And I'm going to delve into those myself, you know, like the how do I feel right now, and bringing yourself to that right now. How do I feel right now? What do I need right now? And what would I love to feel? And, you know, what would I, What would I love? You know, that's really simple stuff, but really powerful. And it, you know, the stuff that he was talking about in terms of that, entering into the kind of coaching mindset of, coming with a behavior change that you want for in order to get a different outcome, and how actually it's the underlying stuff that, so often we need to look at is those roots. It kind of really, I felt kind of vindicated in my approach to slow coaching, and the whole idea about, you know, being a gentle rebel slow coach, because that's what it's all about. It's all about changing those roots and looking deep into those roots and figuring out, you know, is the thing that I think I want the thing that I actually want, or is it just kind of a manifestation of the desire to be worthy, to appease some story that I've come to believe about myself. And it's about changing those stories so that we come into that fullness of being who we actually are, rather than who we think we're supposed to be in order to be worthy and to fit in and to belong. Yeah, if that makes sense. So yeah, that was quite cool. And I'm glad we got to talk about the cure being the creative cure being the cure for the quest of a cure. And yeah, I love all that stuff. Just this idea that, you know, oh, this is going to be the answer to this thing. The cure. If you do this, then you'll get to this magical cure. And actually, and it's so intangible, isn't it? But it does make sense that actually the practice itself is the cure. As you practice this stuff, those moments are the cure, rather than they're contributing to you getting to the cure. And yeah, I'm sure it's stuff that I'll talk about a lot more into the future. But I know I've talked about it in the past in similar ways. But yeah, so I wasn't going to do an extended play podcast, a private podcast this week on Patreon, because I'm putting out the second chapter of The Prisoner. And I don't want to kind of overwhelm Patreon subscribers, but I kind of feel there is a need to unpack a little bit more around this stuff once I've processed it. I think, yeah, I don't know how I'm going to process it, but I need to sleep on it maybe a couple of nights. And yeah, I'll probably hop onto Patreon and share some more thoughts about this stuff, because it's just a beautiful topic to talk about. The Prisoner, in case you're new here, or weren't listening 2 weeks ago, is the novella that I released alongside my album One World Less back in 2011, a little while ago. But then I kind of pulled it from view because I didn't want anyone to see it, basically. It was one of those things. And I can see, I'm kind of half glad as I revisit it. But it's a historical artifact now, so I feel okay about sharing it. But again, only in a safe Patreon private space among friends. So if you're interested to listen to me read that, then yeah, I'm kind of serializing it. So yeah, each putting out one part every sort of 2 or 3 weeks through the year, because it was divided up into seasons. So it starts winter, spring, summer, autumn, you know, the seasons. And yeah, so I'm going to kind of share it like that through this year as well. So yeah, if you want to hear me reading it and playing the songs from the album, and so I'm doing those kind of live. I read out the chapter and then play the song that corresponds with that particular part. Then go to Patreon. It's a place to go. patreon.com/AndyMort. Yeah, and a massive huge thanks to, massive huge thanks to Sarah Williams, to Kendra Patterson, and to Lindsay Celeste for joining the Sustaining Gentle Rebel community this week. Absolutely lovely to welcome you all into the fold. It's amazing to be able to keep doing this because of people like you and because of you. So thank you so much. Both Kendra and Celeste have really great new podcasts for Gentle Rebels, and I'm hoping to speak to both of them at some point in the coming weeks and months on this show. Kendra has launched the Stepping Off Now podcast, where she talks about her experience with the kind of burnout and recovery in order to and she kind of uses those experiences to help fellow creative misfits build rewarding lives outside of the normal boxes laid out for us by society, basically. And Celeste publishes the Magic for Realists podcast, which is a lovely kind of meandering exploration through the poetic nature of everyday life, kind of seeing the beauty in the ordinary and the fascinating in the seemingly mundane, and kind of turning chores into meditations, which is something I really enjoy and really love the idea of. So, yeah, I look forward to speaking to both of them, Kendra and Celeste, at some point in the future. That sounds like some kind of music duo. I'm thinking of Daphne and Celeste. Yeah. I don't think it's them. Anyway, as for you, if you want kind of more songs and personal stories and unscripted philosophical fun and nonsense, then go to patreon.com/AndyMort. And yeah, it's $3 a month. You get access to all the extra stuff that I put out there, including new music and conversations about creativity in life and the deeper challenges that we face alone together in this world. And I'll give you a shout out in a future episode as well, unless you don't want one. That's not obligatory. So if that feels a bit like, you know, as scary as having everyone in a restaurant sing happy birthday to you, then when you sign up, just send me a message and say, yeah, just don't say my name, please. And I'll give you the cake in private. This has been great. And I really appreciate appreciate you listening, and I really appreciate Jacob taking the time out of what I know is a really busy schedule at the moment around the book launch. So, lovely of him to make time in his diary for that. And I hope you've appreciated what he had to say. I don't think I've got anything more to add other than I will endeavour to hop onto Patreon and share some more thoughts around what I just probably need to have a rest first, because I don't know, my brain is both dancing and fatigued from our conversation. It's a beautiful thing. Maybe I'll go out and play some football in the garden before I go to bed. So thank you so much for listening today. I'd love to just ask you a big favor before we go. The best thing you can do to support the podcast and allow it to find the ears of people who are searching for encouragement and support with these things, other than obviously to become a Patreon supporter, the second best thing you can do is give the podcast a good rating and leave a nice review wherever you are listening to this right now. And please do share it with others on social media. It all really, really genuinely helps. We don't just say that on podcasts. I know everybody says it. It does actually get it into more ears. So if you've appreciated any of it, then maybe somebody else will as well. So I'd really be really grateful to you for doing that. I'm getting all tangled up now. So yeah, I'm really grateful to all of you who've supported this stuff in such ways. So yeah, I love you all. All right, I'll be back again next time with another episode of the Gentle Rebel podcast. Until then, do remember that you are an artist. The world needs your art. Now go and make somebody's day. Goodbye. The angels in disguise, we can be.